Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books and Gender Studies. I am the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation is with Sky C. Cleary, a philosopher, writer, and university teacher. Her new book, How to Be Authentic, Simone de Beauvoir and the Quest for Fulfillment, published by St. Martin's Press, is our topic of conversation. Cleary offers an introduction to Beauvoir's thinking about authenticity and how experience and situations shape the people we become. For Beauvoir, an existential philosopher, we first exist and spend our lives not uncovering who we are, but of constructing our identity. Authenticity is the pursuit of self-creation and self-renewal. Under patriarchy, women receive a set of myths that stand in the way of taking responsibility for our freedom. Through the experiences and milestones of friendship, love, marriage, children, and confronting death, we have an opportunity to choose who we will become. Because we live in interdependence with others, Beauvoir's philosophy of the self and genuine living allows others to also achieve freedom in self-creation through reciprocity. Cleary has given us a lively written book drawing not only from Beauvoir's life, but her own experience in self-creation. Here is my conversation with Sky Cleary. Thank you for sharing your book with us. And before we get started talking about how to be authentic, tell us about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Sure. So, long story short, I studied a little bit of philosophy in my undergraduate degree, but it didn't really grab me. It was very, an analytical introduction. And it wasn't until I was studying for an MBA, because I went and worked in financial markets for a while, and I then went and did an MBA. And the place where I did my MBA at Macquarie University in Sydney, there were some philosophers on faculty who would teach courses, MBA courses with, philosophy as part of them, like existentialism and entrepreneurship and, organizational behavior about, existential dynamics in the boardroom and foundations of management thinking. And I was astounded. I was like, wow, why wasn't I taught this in my undergraduate degree? And one of the professors recommended some books on Simone de Beauvoir, because I'd asked, what should I read? And started reading, I think The Mandarins was the first of Simone de Beauvoir's books that I read. And I was just hooked. And it was also about that time that another book came out, called Tête-à-Tête by Hazel Rowley, and which was all about the relationship between Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre, and they seemed to be dealing with similar questions that I was facing at that point in my life about, you know, the tensions between, you know, freedom and responsibility, and, you know, career and boyfriends and family, and trying to balance time, and, you know, questions of what it means to be authentic, and how can you, I guess, live authentically when there are so many pressures on you from other, you know, whether it's friends, family, culture, that sort of thing. So I started to get really interested in the language and the framework that especially Simone de Beauvoir kind of talked about. And then it started on with my other book that you already know, Existentialism and Romantic Love, because I think the most pressing question for me at that point was about romantic relationships. And then sort of authenticity was something that was always in the back of my mind that I was trying to work through. And it was, at some point a few years ago, it was like, right, I need to dig into this deeper. And I know Simone de Beauvoir has a lot to say, but of course she doesn't, you know, she didn't write a specific book on authenticity, and it's sort of infused throughout a lot of her different works. And so this book was How to Be Authentic. My new book was about trying to, you know, untangle some of those ideas and figure out, you know, a cohesive idea of Beauvoir's view of authenticity.
Okay. Well, you know, the word authenticity gets thrown around a lot. But before we go to that one, I want to ask you, for some of the listeners who may not know who Simone de Beauvoir is, can you say something about who she was and why is she still relevant?
Yeah, sure. So Simone de Beauvoir she lived in Paris. She was born 1908, died 1986. And she was, you know, she was a child during World War I and lived through World War II. And it was really around that time, you know, before, during, and after World War II, that she really focused on writing. And, you know, back then, it was a really bleak time in world history. There were just a lot of, you know, political tumultuousness, and, you know, people were asking questions, and Simone de Beauvoir was asking questions, you know, how do you live amidst these horrors, and how do we know what to do? How do we think about what our responsibility to others is?
I know that she was an existentialist. How is she different from other existentialists? What makes her existentialism unique?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, I'll say she really pushed back on the label of existentialist. It was something that I think Gabriel Marcel started calling Jean-Paul Sartre, who was Beauvoir's lifelong partner. And, you know, people just started calling Beauvoir and Sartre existentialists, and they pushed back on it for a while because they, you know, part of their philosophy is not being defined by labels specifically. They're like that we're so much more than any specific label or role can sum us up in. But, you know, at some point, you know, it sort of got out of control and they just said, okay, well, fine. If we have to be called something, fine. Call us existentialists. Although I try and say existential philosophers, because I guess they were philosophers first, and, you know, existentialism was kind of their flavor, I think. And why I think Beauvoir is different is because she systematically tried to look at ethics from an existential perspective. And so Jean-Paul Sartre, for example, he wrote Being and Nothingness, and you know, he kind of touched a tiny bit on ethics and said in a footnote in Being and Nothingness that at some point he would write, you know, a book on ethics, but he never did. And it was really Beauvoir, starting with essays like The Ethics of Ambiguity and Pyrrhus and Cineas, that she really focused on ethics. And the question is, well, if God is dead, does anything go? And that was kind of Dostoevsky's, you know, idea. And, you know, she really searched hard for an answer to that question throughout a lot of her different works. So it's sort of this sustained, you know, consideration of, you know, how do we found an ethics if there is no God to, that's going to punish us for not respecting other people. And what she came up with in the Ethics of Ambiguity and elsewhere, that it's really, you know, this idea of intersubjectivity, which is we confound ethics in our relationships with other people because we coexist, because we share the same human condition.
Okay, so back to authenticity, which is the title of your book. So what does it mean to be yourself? I mean, authenticity is kind of like, oh, you say, oh, this person's very authentic. I just want to be authentic. I want to be true to myself. What does it mean to be true to yourself? What does it mean to be authentic?
Yeah, so first of all, I would say that Beauvoir's idea of authenticity isn't about being yourself as it is about becoming yourself. So that's an important distinction, because her idea of authenticity is very outward looking. It's about engaging in the world with other people. It's about going and doing things. And it's not a process of, you know, armchair philosophizing where you sit and you try and peel off the layers of your being like an onion to find whatever, you know, hard, authentic self there is inside. You know, for Beauvoir, you know, okay, think about a painting. When we're talking about a painting, you can talk about it being authentic in terms of, oh, was this the original? Was this painted by the author who claims to have painted it? So it's a static thing. But when it comes to human beings, we're not static things. You know, we're always growing. We're always changing and becoming more than we are. And so for Beauvoir, it's meaningless to talk about, you know, authentic in terms of looking for whatever fixed original self there is within inside yourself. Rather, authenticity is a process of becoming. And this comes from the existential idea that existence precedes essence. So we exist first and then we create our essence. We create who we become. And that's a way of expressing our freedom. Very more outward looking and, you know, dynamic. So authenticity is therefore, you know, a process in Beauvoir's idea of it.
Now, Beauvoir in her book, The Second Sex, really talked a lot about how women pretty much give up their freedom of self-creation and become inauthentic very easily. Can you talk about how women, as she saw it and you see it, because you put yourself a lot into the book, you talk a lot about your own experiences. What are the particular traps that women have that really keep them from fulfilling that authenticity and really exercising their freedom to become who they would like to become?
Yeah, so there's a lot of what Beauvoir called mystifications about, and which are sort of false ideas and myths about who we are, who we're supposed to be, what is natural for us to do. And mystifications are often used as a form of oppression. And Beauvoir thought mystifications were a way of keeping women as the second sex, which is the title of her most famous book, which was written in 1949, called The Second Sex. And one of the biggest mystifications when it comes to women is that there is this thing called like the eternal feminine, or, you know, some kind of feminine nature or even masculine nature, that are these fixed essences that we have depending on what, you know, sex organs we're born with. But for Beauvoir, because existence precedes essence, you know, there's no such thing as like masculine or feminine nature. Rather, the way we become women or the way we become men is very much shaped by our context, by our situation, by, you know, what we're rewarded for or punished for. And so this is a particular problem for women because they're brought up to be pretty and passive and not to take up space, whereas boys tend to be brought up to be masculine, which is all about being strong and climbing trees and being rough. And so, although Beauvoir focuses mostly on women and how this presents a problem for women in the second sex unit, she also does acknowledge that these mystifications channel men into specific roles as well. And they, you know, in some ways actually, like for example, girls are now, you know, not punished for wearing more masculine clothes, but boys can't wear feminine clothes and dresses in the same way that girls can. So in some ways, they're kind of policed, or they're the way they present themselves is policed as well.
Okay, so how does self-creation, that process, interact with others who are also self-creating? So, does that lead to some sort of conflict? How do we encounter that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir thought that, you know, really the problem, one of the biggest problems we have between the sexes is that we've sort of evolved to have our, you know, interpersonal relationships based on domination and conflict. And she saw friendship as a really important way to kind of overcome this tension. And she's like, well, actually, the real task of feminism is to try and change the way the world operates from domination to freedom. And so on a personal level, Beauvoir talked about in existential terms, there are a couple of different dimensions of being. There is being for yourself, which is sort of this, you know, choosing your own life from, you know, a range of options, but also being for others, because we live in context with other people. And authenticity isn't just about being for yourself, because that you end up in, you know, self-interest and egoism. And of course, Beauvoir thought that we can only become authentic through our relationships and engaging with other people. So being for others is really important as well. But so often being for others or being with others is a very kind of, as you say, full of conflict and tension, and it's a hostile relationship. And this was something that, say, Jean-Paul Sartre talks a lot about in Being and Nothingness. But Beauvoir thought that we can overcome these tensions by developing friendly relationships with others, like trying to find a kind of a harmonious being with others. So finding a balance between, you know, being for others and being for ourselves. And this kind of tension, she thought, could be managed with what I was talking about before, intersubjectivity, which is the mutual recognition of one another's freedom and facticity. Now, that's not to say that we should obliterate all conflict between people, because, you know, there is such a thing as constructive criticism and constructive conflict that can call our being into question. And that's why she thought, you know, great friends aren't people who just tolerate you and say yes to anything you do, but great friends are really ones who push you and challenge you in safe ways.
Well, it's like what you're talking about, beans for others. It seems that women have a real talent for that.
Yes, and exactly. And she's, yeah, you're right. And that was one of the mystifications that she talked about, that, you know, women are kind of groomed into being for others, to give everything. And this is one of the mystifications of the ideal mother. You know, an ideal mother is someone that, you know, obliterates her whole self for the child, or, you know, the perfect wife is someone who obliterates themselves for their partner. And, you know, this manifests in a lot of different ways that women are expected to be caregivers. And of course, we see this in jobs as well, where women are the ones who are kind of channeled into caregiving roles that are paid less, whereas men tend to be channeled into, you know, higher paid jobs and taking on leadership positions. And I mean, just look at, you know, how many Fortune 100 or 500 companies are run by women. Very few, and even fewer by women of color. So this kind of notion that women are expected to be for others rather than for themselves is, really one of the critical problems that Beauvoir talked about in The Second Sex. And this is one of the reasons why I think she's still so relevant is because we're still seeing the same problems that she was dealing with.
And even in the office, in corporate office, you have women or like the office wife, the office mother, the office counselor, the office comforter in chief. It's the women who take that up.
Exactly. And, and one of the things behind this is like people say, oh, well, it's just women are naturally better suited to that. But Beauvoir was like, no, it's not nature. There's nothing, at the core. It's socialization that pushes women into these caregiving roles. And caregiving is expected of women. Like caregiving, women are expected to give and give of themselves until there's nothing left. And actually, Kate Mann in Down Girl talks about this famous story, Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree, and how literally it's the story about a mother who gives herself until there's nothing left. And this story is kind of valorized as the ideal motherhood. But, Kate Mann says that this is actually, a really terrifying and atrocious story. And I think Beauvoir would agree with that.
So you follow Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex in some of the framework, but she starts with you start with friendship and talking about friendship being sort of a true friendship, a healthy friendship is sort of an ideal situation. So how is a friendship a good model for relating to others? I mean, and how can that translate to other things like motherhood or a romantic relationship?
Sure. So friendship that's based on what I was talking about, intersubjectivity, that is a relationship that's reciprocal and cooperative and constructive and makes space for the other person's freedom, the other person's subjectivity, is... that kind of what she was talking about with this ideal friendship and ideal relationships. And yeah, as you say, that's kind of the foundation of all relationships. One of the things she talks about is that in romantic relationships, so often it's, certainly throughout history, is that women were channeled into this, even if it's not the romantic ideal, but channeled into getting married, being defined by who they were married to, and often expected to either give up their career or take a back seat in their career for their partner, and which creates all sorts of oppressive structures and power games within love relationships, because it comes back to this idea that women are supposed to be for others. And we see that so often in marriages, and that's kind of the traditional idea of marriage. But Beauvoir thought that romantic relationships could be so much stronger and so much better if they were based on this idea of great friendship, of intersubjectivity. And so you were also asking about how that translates into motherhood.
Yes, I have some particular questions about that, because historically it's been a short time since we've actually have made motherhood has become a choice. Now we're kind of in this kind of, weird place, but, historically, women have not been able to make that choice very effectively. And in a relative free situation as we are today, and I say relative.
In some places.
How does choosing motherhood require, does it require that you know what you're getting into? And if you're a first-time mother, you really don't know what you're leaping into. It's a leap of faith. You don't know what you're going to get. And the thing about it with a mother-child relationship, a child has to be socialized into being, understanding the mutuality of the relationship. Because they're not born knowing that. What does it mean to be an authentic in motherhood? In both the choice and how it plays out with a child who doesn't understand mutuality.
Yeah, this is a good question. And Beauvoir's definition of authentic love in the second sex is a mutual recognition of two freedoms, and neither person mutilates themselves, neither person gives up their freedom. And so, of course, as you say, the question is, well, okay, you know, a child isn't exactly free. They're not, you know, responsible for their actions, but you know, I think Beauvoir suggests that there are possibilities for authentic motherhood. And first of all, is what's critically important is having a choice. I had no idea what I was getting. Most women don't have any idea what they're getting into. You know, maybe that's part of the kind of conspiracy theory to push us into these ideas of, you know, the ideal mother is one who is like loves being in her role and who doesn't complain and who like is just, and if you're not that kind of perfect mother, then maybe there's something wrong with you. You know, these are sort of some of the mystifications that are around. And so I think the way we apply Beauvoir's philosophy in motherhood is thinking about, you know, the relationship and how, you know, parenthood or caregiving is about kind of nurturing the relationship and, you know, supporting children in understanding that the best foundation for relationships is intersubjectivity and showing them and being a good role model for that.
So, yeah, I'm just wondering if one of the tasks of parenting is to teach your child that there is a limit to what the parent gives.
Yeah.
That there's a boundary. Mm-hmm. You know, your mother or father can't be here for everything and do everything for you.
Yeah, it's an exercise in supporting your kid and becoming independent and, you know, but in safe ways. You know, you don't want them, you know, just running out onto the street. You know, there's a role for parenthood to put limits on it. But it's like, yeah, I think you're right. It's about creating a context and a situation where children can learn in safe ways until they're, you know, old enough to take responsibility for their own actions.
And right, and that their mothers have a life outside being mothers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Beauvoir says in The Second Sex, I don't remember the quote exactly, but something like, you know, the mother who has the richest life will have the most to give her child because she has, you know, diversity of experiences and activities and things and will be the most capable of kind of supporting her child in exercising their own freedom and flourishing in the world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what do you think the dangers of motherhood are today? Are they mostly cultural dangers?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the most obvious danger is not being able to choose it and to be thrown into a situation that you are not prepared for and don't want to be in. And you know, Beauvoir back in the 1970s and 60s was fighting really hard in France for women's right to access birth control and abortion. And so, I think that's that. Making sure that motherhood is a choice that we can take on seriously and take full responsibility for, because, you know, Beauvoir was like, you know, if you don't have a choice in some things, how, you know, it's absurd to ask people to be responsible for things they didn't choose.
Right. But once you're in a situation that you got through a lot of situations in life are situations where we're thrown into life. We're not even just motherhood, other situations. You know, we didn't choose it. We just, like, we don't choose our parents, you know, a lot of things where we were born. And we have to deal with the world that's kind of we're thrown into.
Yeah. And this is what Beauvoir, I think, would have referred to as our facticity. So the facts of our existence. I mean, life is we're thrown into life. We don't choose to be born. But I think Beauvoir would say, yeah, okay, so sometimes we do find ourselves in these situations that we didn't choose. But you know, the thing is, what's important is that the past, we're the sum of our actions. So we are the sum of these choices that we've made in the past that make us who we are now. But that's not all we are. We're also how we project ourselves into the future. We're also those goals we set for ourselves and the attitude with which we orient ourselves towards those ends. So fine, we need, and I think what she would suggest is that, yeah, we need to embrace who we are. Okay, we can't change the past, but focus on where we're going, focus on the future.
Right. And how the different choices within the freedoms that we have to make the choices that are most authentic to us, that who we want to become. Okay, let's go into this. What does authenticity have to do with, how does it work with the freedom to self-create? How does it work when you're dealing with old age and you're facing death and maybe your time horizon is not, you know, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, and in fact, Beauvoir saw this as one of the biggest questions of life. You know, if you're lucky enough to make it to old age, which, you know, not everyone is, and, you know, she saw, she actually wrote a whole book about aging called Old Age, which isn't a very famous book. Sometimes it's called Coming of Age, but it was her trying to come to terms with growing old and death, and how do you keep, you know, being enthusiastic about life when you don't actually have much life left. And she also saw it to be a real problem that our societies, and not just our current society or her current society, but so many societies are ageist in many ways.
She was too. She had a very, you know, she was 40 years old and she thought her life was over.
Yes, she did. And she thought she'd never have sex again. And, you know, when a younger man called her up and asked her on a date when she was 39, she was beside herself because she didn't understand that she could be a sexual being at the ripe old age of 39. So, yeah, she was ageist, and she'd internalized, you know, a lot of ageism. And in the book Old Age, she talks about it in terms of old age, in terms of exis and praxis. So adults are mostly praxis. So they're doing, they're transcending, they're, you know, working, and they're useful to society. Whereas children and older people are exis. So they just exist. They're not really, you know, being productive. But the difference between children and older people is that children are going to be future praxis. So they're going to be, in the future, they'll be useful to society. But, you know, older adults are discriminated against so much because they're treated as if they don't have potential, as if they don't have a future. And, you know, Beauvoir thought it was crazy that people are creating policies and laws that discriminate against older people, because those people in power are the ones who are going to be old themselves in the future. But the thing is that a lot of those people in power are wealthy, and they don't fear, and they can sort of slide into old age comfortably themselves.
I think one of the big problems with the old age, I kind of wonder what you think about this, is that if you've been making choices and you're becoming yourself, you could get to the end of your life and say, I don't like what I have become. You have made so many choices that are layered upon layered upon layer that have taken you in so many different ways that you may not like what you became. And I think that that's where you have a lot of bitterness in old age, because people have a lot of, they regrets. The regrets, they are regretting lots of choices that they've made.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think that's the beauty of Beauvoir's existentialism, is that she kind of says, you know, it's never too late to change. You know, what matters is what we do with the time we have left. We're never complete. We're never done until we're actually dead. And so she's like, sure, growing older kind of triggers like an identity crisis for reasons such as you mentioned. But, you know, she says, you know, it's... Sorry, I'm trying to remember some of her quotes. She says, you know, don't gamble on the future, act now without delay. Like, no, you still have time left. So, you know, we should be throwing ourselves into projects. And sure, the facticity of our life, you know, our bodies mightn't be as vibrant as they were. But she's like, whatever facts of our life, fine, let's acknowledge those and look for whatever window of freedom we do have left. So let's not die before we're dead. And that's kind of one of the big messages of this old age, which she wrote when she was growing old and trying to help herself come to terms with it and think about how to project herself forward. But it's not easy, and she really, really struggled with it.
Well, in your third part of your book, you talk about self-sabotage, because our culture can sabotage us in multiple ways all our life. But how do we sabotage ourselves? What is it that we do?
Yeah. I mean, lots of ways. I mean, one of the main ways is giving up our freedom and just, you know, going with the flow and not being active agents of our lives, or, you know, and that's what Beauvoir called bad faith, which is, you know, pretending we don't have choices when we do. Some of the other ways, you know, one of the ways I talk about in the book is, you know, Beauvoir had a section in her book, The Second Sex, on narcissism. And, you know, I think we're seeing a lot of this now, especially on social media, which is, you know, kind of creating an idealized image of yourself that you're presenting to the world, which isn't reflective of reality. And it's a way of, you know, we're masking our real appearances, and we're kind of putting an image out there that suggests that, you know, we have it all together, and that's a problem for Beauvoir, because she's like, you know, no one is ever, you know, complete, and we're actually always evolving, and our beings are fragmentary, and we're never going to be complete until death. So you know, I think she would have an issue with social media in that way. And, you know, some other ways that we sabotage ourselves is, you know, further, like narcissism, you know, supporting ourselves to other people or other, like, you know, I'm thinking about one of the examples I put in my book is, you know, sometimes mysticism can be a form of self-sabotage. You know, it's, voluntarily subordinating ourselves or to, you know, some kind of other power, not necessarily God, but, you know, some kind of spirituality. But, you know, what's interesting is also one of Beauvoir's kind of existential heroes is the mystic Saint Teresa of Avila. And Beauvoir talks about Saint Teresa as being, you know, very passionate. She, St. Teresa, you know, chooses her own quests, and she's not beholden to her passions. And St. Teresa was kind of an iconoclast as well. She rebelled against her father to become a nun. She rebelled against the Spanish Inquisition and the Protestant Reformation. And she also rebelled against what was expected of a woman. So she was around in the 1600s, I want to say. Don't quote me on that. But, you know, and women weren't supposed to be teachers. And there she was, you know, advising people, teaching people, giving people advice. And she really pushed back on what she was supposed to do. And she was almost, you know, buried alive a bunch of times. She was almost arrested a bunch of times. So she, you know, Beauvoir thought this was, you know, an example of kind of someone who was pursuing their authenticity and creating themselves in really authentic ways.
Well, the thing about this that always puzzles me is that, of course, you may actually know that you would rather make another choice, but you don't make that choice, not because you're self-deceived or bad faith, it's because you understand the consequences of what that choice would mean in terms of backlash and people, all kinds of, they can be all kinds of collateral damage to your choice.
Yeah.
So that requires an incredible amount of courage and willing to, if you're going to take your freedom, then you have to take the consequences of that freedom, which can be quite severe. I mean, very severe.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, for example, St. Teresa faced, you know, really severe consequences.
Right. So I don't know if everybody's in the position to do that. And it doesn't, yeah. And it doesn't necessarily mean that people are being inauthentic. They're just saying, I realize I would rather do this, but I've got to do this or I'm going to like suffer the consequences, and they're really, really hard.
Yeah. And I think that's true. But, you know, I think Beauvoir was very sympathetic to that because, you know, authenticity isn't about, you know, going out and doing whatever the hell we want and exercising radical freedom and stuff. No, she was like, no, it's life is a tension between being for yourself and being for others. We need to take other people into account when we make decisions. But, you know, we also need to live with the decision that we haven't taken the path that maybe we would have preferred to at that moment because we prioritized our relationships with other people over that choice. But what she was saying is that, you know, as long as we were cognizant of the choice and as long as we're not choosing that other path because of oppression or because, you know, where we would be punished if we did otherwise. But no, if we can, you know, make that choice with full awareness that of why we're doing. And, you know, Beauvoir knew that, you know, people were in all sorts of, you know, really nuanced situations, and it's really hard to judge, you know, the context of another person and the choices that they make. And, you know, she knew that these choices that we do make are a really complex formula that goes on in our head, and you know we can't judge other people for, you know, making choices that maybe we don't approve of. And
so I'm kind of wondering, is seeking authenticity the same as pursuing happiness, or could you seek authenticity and become very authentic and still not be happy?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. You can. But I think Beauvoir thought that happiness would be a consequence of pursuing authenticity. So, and she was very worried about, you know, the idea of, you know, chasing happiness directly. But, you know, happiness, she thought, comes from embracing our freedom, you know, acknowledging the context of our lives, being lucid about the context of our lives and taking responsibility for our choices and, you know, creating intersubjective relationships with one another and our world. And, you know, this kind of, you know, she says something like happiness is never given. You know, we need to embrace, you know, the ambiguity of the world and acknowledge there will always be tensions and conflicts with other people. But, you know, the more we can pursue our lives in authentic ways, you know, the more we're probably going to be you know, find happiness and joy in what we're doing.
So what would you like the reader to get from reading your book? I mean, what's the main idea? What would you like for this book to do for people?
Yeah, I would like people to realize that authenticity is possible. Although it's a receding goal. So what I mean is, like, authenticity isn't something like now I'm authentic. It's because authenticity exists in the choices we make, and it exists in and through our relationships. It's always a process. And so what's important is that if we orient our lives in authentic ways, then it's an attitude. So I would like for people to take on the attitude of authenticity more in their lives and be aware of these mystifications that oppress us, and try and untangle those kind of facts and myths from our lives.
It seems that a lot of this authenticity is wrapped up with self-knowledge, knowing yourself, knowing where you're going, knowing what you want to become, knowing being aware of your situation that you're embedded in, which is a big part of it. She talks a lot about situation, about being in this, we're in a situation, and that's often not chosen. And being aware of all that, the complexities of the situation, and also your own desires of where you want to go. And that requires a lot of self-knowledge.
So I
don't mean self-knowledge like, I don't mean self-knowledge like you, there's some authentic self inside that you're somebody that you're looking for. It's meaning aware how you respond and what the possibilities are within the situation you're in.
Well, I think the Beauvoir's attitude is more, what's important is self-learning. It's self-reflection. It's, you know, it's not necessarily, oh, these are my desires and this is where I'm going. You know, sometimes we don't know whether we want to do something until we've actually done it, until we've actually tried it and thrown ourselves into it. But it's this attitude of saying, okay, I'm gonna try this and, you know, learn about how I am in that situation, learn about how other people are around me are in that situation. And so I think it's more of a reflective and ongoing learning process. And as you say, being aware, but it's not like, oh, there's all this work you have to do to know yourself first before you can go out in the world. No, we need to go out in the world and yeah. Do things.
Sometimes you become who you are by what you do, and you know who you are by what you do.
Yeah. But what she was, you know, she didn't want us to just kind of blindly plod through life. No, she's like, okay, let's think about where we want to go, you know, be courageous, leap into life, and, you know, reflect on what we're doing and be aware. And it's also, and you talked about, you know, how, like, complexity, and you know, Beauvoir was, you know, extremely attuned to the complexity of different situations, which is why she wrote a lot of novels and kind of explored these kind of not just her philosophy.
But she didn't want to think of herself as a philosopher because she thought that her philosophy was in her novels.
Yeah, and she was a philosopher in her own right, even though she claimed she wasn't. I mean, she wrote philosophical essays and books, but and it's not just, and philosophy, of course, can be done through novels and plays and, you know, poems. And in fact, those kind of forms of more imaginative forms, maybe they can even prompt us to, you know, think about our own lives more deeply. And in fact, that was kind of Kierkegaard's idea. You know, he wrote novels and wrote them under pseudonyms because he wanted readers to challenge readers to think for themselves. And that's kind of what philosophy is doing. And I think that's what Beauvoir was doing with her novels as well, challenging us to think about the different complexities and contexts of people in different situations.
Okay, well, Sky, thank you for your time. Thank you very much.
No, thanks, Lillian.
And yeah, and thank you to our listeners for another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.